This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Social media has become a fundamental part of politics. What once used to be discussed mainly on the floors of Parliament buildings, perhaps in a broadcast interview, is now posted online in seconds, politicians engaging directly with their electorates. It's launched movements, trends and beliefs across the world, but it's also regularly blamed for spreading falsehoods, unsubstantiated rumour, hate speech and dangerous lies. Major social media platforms have become very powerful, as have their owners. Ex-owner Elon Musk, now photographed next to President-elect Trump, more times, it seems, than his vice president-elect or even his wife. Today, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced some changes to Facebook and other Meta platforms such as Instagram, moving away from using third-party fact-checkers towards a community note system, also used by X, which relies on users themselves to monitor inaccurate or false posts. In making the announcement, he accused the fact-checkers of being politically biased.
First, we're going to get rid of fact-checkers and replace them with community notes similar to X, starting in the US. After Trump first got elected in 2016, the legacy media wrote nonstop about how misinformation was a threat to democracy. We tried in good faith to address those concerns without becoming the arbiters of truth. But the fact-checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the US.
Mr. Zuckerberg went on to say those who decided what was acceptable discourse on Facebook had been too restrictive.
We're going to simplify our content policies and get rid of a bunch of restrictions on topics like immigration and gender that are just out of touch with mainstream discourse. What started as a movement to be more inclusive has increasingly been used to shut down opinions and shut out people with different ideas, and it's gone too far.
Well, earlier I caught up with John Samples. He's vice president of the right-leaning think tank, the Cato Institute. He's also a member of Facebook's 21-person independent oversight board that adjudicates on whether content should be censored or taken down. I asked him why Mark Zuckerberg had made this decision today to abandon fact-checkers, and did he think it was the right one?
I'm pleased with it. I think in some ways people are missing the point about it because there's been a lot of talk about these fact-checking institutions, which many people in the United States believe were biased, and they caused a lot of problems enabling government bullying and censorship during the pandemic. So they were really part of the past already. But what's stunning about this statement was it was about Meta's future, and it made some very important points about that. For several years, Meta has tried to placate Europe and the European Union with regard to the Digital Services Act. Meta seems to be enlisting the new administration as an ally in a conflict.
If we can just go back to the fact-checking element, which, as you say, is the headline. And you mentioned there, you said that politicians had been bullying people during the pandemic. It did become very political on social media. But I'm just seeing here a study published in the American Journal of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene actually found that they thought somewhere above 5,000 people had been admitted to hospital as a result of false information on social media because they'd been drinking methanol, alcohol-based cleaning products, which was one of those rumours that was going around on social media, including Facebook and Instagram, that cured COVID. That was clearly medically inaccurate and wrong, and yet it obviously had an impact. So fact-checking that would have been helpful, surely.
In fact, that was fact-checked by Meta, and that there was like 80 statements that were taken down on site by Meta during the pandemic. I don't think that's what Mr. Zuckerberg was talking about. He might have been talking about two things. One was the taking down of the origins of the virus, which was a controversial and remains controversial to this day and should be discussed by the public. So I think Zuckerberg's not talking about these clear cases, well, but rather about the margins.
Just to use his own words, he actually says that fact checkers were too politically biased. If that is a problem, surely that's an issue of recruitment, isn't it? And what's the evidence that they are politically biased?
Meta's problem was that they have to have credibility with large parts of the population. And they simply, on these issues, on content moderation, they have become aware in the last couple of years, not just recently, that they have not gained much credibility in, despite their efforts to assure that kind of neutrality. And that for half of America, or as Mr. Trump proved, over half of the United States electorate, fact-checking was simply not credible. I do think when you look at what the fact-checkers were, their background, it's, you know, highly implausible that they were going to give anything other than an establishment view of these things.
Okay, well, I mean, he accuses the fact-checkers of bias, but isn't he himself, Mr. Zuckerberg, showing political bias now, saying he is, as you say, going to work with President Trump? We know that he's given quite a sizable donation towards the inauguration later this month as well, and some quite interesting comments towards the end of his speech, talking about working with President Trump to push back on governments around the world going after American companies. No doubt he's talking about his own. I mean, this is a trade-off, isn't it? That we'll back you, Trump, if you back us in places like Europe and China.
Well, it's also the fact that Mr. Zuckerberg has an obligation, legal and moral, to maximize shareholder value. And he also has a commitment, I think, that goes back, as he mentions in that statement, to 2019, to freedom of speech. And what happened during the pandemic and what happened with the Biden jawboning of Meta, I think, led him to conclude, there's strong evidence that he said to his employees that we made big mistakes there, that we gave up too much ground on freedom of speech. So I think that's part of the story. But it's also true that the regulatory environment, particularly in Europe, but also he's really talking about Brazil, having these secret kind of rulings where they're required to take down speech that is often anti-government or something like that. So I think, as always, with anybody in these situations, particularly a business person, there's a number of reasons why something is done. But in this case, I think there's a mixture of his concern for free speech, but also the business itself over time.
John Samples there, Vice President of the Cato Institute and on Facebook's Independent Oversight Board. Well, James Ball is a technology writer and author of The System, Who Owns the Internet and How It Owns Us. He came into the NewsHour studio earlier. So what's his take on Mark Zuckerberg's decision today and those comments from John Samples?
When both men say this is about credibility, they're right. But I think there are two big questions of credibility from what Mark Zuckerberg has done today. And one of those is purely US facing. He's nixing independent fact checkers. He's moving Facebook's own moderation team from California to Texas. He is talking about working more closely with the Trump administration. He's replaced Nick Clegg with Joel Kaplan, a Republican operator. He's very obviously timed this and signaled this to be about being more friendly to the Trump White House. Now, there are 50 million Americans who voted for Kamala. There are many more Americans who didn't vote for either, who may be looking at this and saying, well, what signal are you telling us? What credibility should we have for you now? What trust should we have in you? Especially as some of the issues, yes, there were far more fact checks against false claims from the right, but independent studies and public verification showed there were far more false claims coming from the right.
Interesting.
And so essentially, they can't check claims that aren't there. And he's allowed that right-wing narrative to take over, and the changes to the rules suit the Republicans as well. So there's a lot of questions at home, even before you look at the fact that Meta is not just a US company and its customers are not only in America.
Right. What, in terms of how the platforms work, though, with fact checkers or not, this has been done before. We mentioned earlier Elon Musk did this on X, that used the same sort of system. How might that change the platforms that Meta runs?
So Meta at the moment pays for independent newsrooms of fact checkers. There are some here in the UK. There are some across the world, almost on every continent. And they are independent newsrooms that have a certain set of standards, and they're paid by Facebook to monitor and evaluate claims. And essentially, they will tag certain claims as false, provide the evidence, and then those claims don't share as easily on Facebook. They're replacing it with a system much more like X users, Elon Musk's social network, which essentially relies on users to crowdsource fact checks. Now, it's quite a clever system. It was developed by a team back when it was Twitter, before Elon took over. And a note only appears when users of quite different politics all agree on it and have a consensus. That's quite neat, but it means it's very slow. And the notes don't tend to appear very quickly on politically polarized misinformation, which can be some of the most dangerous. What can lead to incitements to violence, to the January the 6th riots, those kind of incidents. And it's very hard to look at X, and there are a lot of threats there, a lot of hate speech, a lot of other issues, and say that this is a good model to follow for a good user experience.
Well, that said, I mean, Mr. Trump himself was banned from various social media, including Facebook, and I think X at one point when it was Twitter. But many of his supporters would say, well, thank goodness he was allowed back on, because he's been allowed his free speech and he's been able to put his policies forward, and we wanted to vote for him.
I don't think not being on the network really caused Donald Trump any political problems. It, in fact, gave him a good sort of source of ire for his followers to tap into. Trump, in fact, launched his own social network, Truth Social, which has now added about $2.5 billion to his net worth. Mm. So I think Donald Trump did quite nicely out of his ban. But they banned him by eventually applying their rules to him after many, many breaches of them.
So I mentioned that politics is now, social media is fundamental now to politics all over the world, not just in the West, but everywhere. But we also see how much power and influence those that run these sites and own them have. How much transparency and accountability is there of those people, such as Mr. Musk and indeed Mr. Zuckerberg?
Elon Musk owns X privately. He doesn't have any public shareholders to be accountable to. He can essentially do whatever he wants. Mark Zuckerberg, Meta is more public. It has shareholders, but it has a special structure that gives Zuckerberg much more voting power. And essentially, as long as he wants to run Facebook, he can. Now, Meta is Facebook, it's Instagram, it's Threads, it's WhatsApp. It has 2 billion users in 100 plus countries. So when he makes a decision, it affects the entire world and many different political systems and social structures. So when he changes them on his own bat to suit US politics and perhaps what he thinks will serve his own interests, it affects us across the planet. And this is shifting from a kind of capitalist model to neo-feudalism. Goodness. This is court politics with Donald Trump.
And that was technology writer James Ball there, author of The System, Who Owns the Internet and How It Owns Us. Coming up later, one of the areas affected by the earthquake today was the Himalayas, and we'll be hearing from a man who was on Mount Everest when it struck.
There were big parts of glaciers collapsing and exploding around me, and the shock waves hit me, and well, some bits of ice hit the tent, and well, let's put it this way, the tent has seen its last expedition.
More on that coming up in about 30 minutes' time. Our top headline this hour, the social media giant Meta is ending fact-checking on Facebook and other platforms, saying it wants to prioritise free expression over censorship. And the outgoing US Secretary of State has accused the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces of committing genocide in Sudan. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. What is Donald Trump Jr. doing in Greenland? He says he's on a short holiday, but given his father, President-elect Donald Trump Sr., has offered to buy Greenland in the past and said again today he wants it to be part of the United States, some might be suspicious about Don Jr.'s new interest there. This is what he said on arrival.
Just here as tourists, seeing it, looks like an incredible place. We've been talking about going for a while. I was actually supposed to be here last spring for some of the stuff I do in my free time, but just really excited to be here. Awesome country. The scenery coming in was just spectacular. So just very excited to be here. Thank you. He says hello.
Okay.
We were talking to him yesterday, so he says hello to everyone in Greenland.
Well, Greenland is a large Arctic island with a population of less than 60,000. It's rich in minerals and has played a strategically important role in the North Atlantic, including by accommodating a large US military base. It's mostly autonomous but comes under the Danish Commonwealth. Is it a coincidence that today the Danish king, Frederick X, changed the Danish coat of arms to increase the size of the polar bear that represents Greenland and also the ram that represents the Faroe Islands? Well, I've been speaking to Aya Chemnitz. She's an MP representing Greenland in the Danish parliament. We recorded this interview today just before President-elect Trump made his latest comments. More on that in a moment. But first, how did she feel about Mr. Trump Jr.'s visit today?
You know, we think it's quite interesting to have American tourists. So Trump Jr. is welcome as an American tourist on a private tour. But I think, of course, the timing is relevant. And I think in many ways, the interest from Trump is something that we're, you know, looking into. And we're, some of us at least, quite concerned about the whole interest that has been shown, especially in owning and controlling Greenland. So In many ways, it's a business opportunity for us, not necessarily to have a closer collaboration on very specific areas instead of being owned and controlled by United States.
And what do you think the interest is based upon? I mean, obviously, Greenland is geographically quite a strategically important territory, and there has been a US military base, a large one there, for many years, hasn't there? But are there other reasons why Mr. Trump might be interested in Greenland?
Greenland is not interested in having more American military bases. I think that's very important to underline. And there's no doubt that the war in Ukraine and the spillover in the Arctic is something that is affecting all of us. So I think more surveillance is, of course, very important for us. But to have a Danish defense is better than to have an American defense. And I think it's important to remember that we have both US as a neighbor, but we also have Russia as a neighbor in the Arctic. So I think in many ways it's about recognizing that Greenland is its own country and the future of Greenland should be decided by the people living in Greenland.
Yes, you mentioned Denmark there, and I think that your party supports independence from Denmark ultimately, doesn't it? But you do serve as a representative for Greenland in the Danish parliament. What do you make of the king today changing the coat of arms? Apparently the polar bear representing Greenland has got considerably bigger in the past few hours. What do you make of that?
I think it's interesting with all the focus on Greenland. I think we need that attention in order to focus on business development in Greenland, whether it's extraction of rare earth minerals in Greenland, whether it's tourism or whether it's a closer collaboration on education and also to some extent on defense together with the U.S.
I wonder if I can ask you what you make of Mr. Trump's assertion that he said recently. I think this may have been on social media. He said, "I'm hearing that the people of Greenland are MAGA," which is like his Make America Great Again. And he ended that message saying, "Make Greenland Great Again." Is it your understanding that there is a lot of support among Greenlandic people? And could they be persuaded to vote in that direction?
No, I don't think there's a lot of interest in it. I think it's more or less a gimmick. I think there will be a closer collaboration on business issues together with the US. And I think the US engagement in Greenland has been quite symbolic. So I would like to see much more engagement, but on a Greenlandic term. I don't think that the people of Greenland are interested in becoming American citizens.
And just lastly, in terms of independence, do you think Greenland would be more protected, safer, if it were independent or if it stayed with Denmark?
I think a good collaboration on Greenlandic terms when it comes to defense, I think it would be better together with Denmark as it is right now. Greenland still needs to have a better economy, if you ask me, just looking at the facts. And therefore, I think it's important to look at into how can you have a more equal partnership with Denmark.
Aaja Chemnitz there, MP for Greenland in the Danish Parliament. Well, shortly after we recorded that interview, President-elect Donald Trump held a press conference in which he repeatedly said that ownership of Greenland was necessary for US national security. He also threatened to return the Panama Canal to US control. This is what he replied to journalists when asked to rule out using military or economic coercion on either front.
No, I can't assure you on either of those two, but I can say this. We need them for economic security. The Panama Canal was built for our military. I'm not going to commit to that now. It might be that you'll have to do something. Look, the Panama Canal is vital to our country. It's being operated by China. And we gave the Panama Canal to Panama. We didn't give it to China. And they've abused it. They've abused that gift.
Well, Panama has denied Mr. Trump's claim that Chinese soldiers were stationed at the canal. Mr. Trump also threatened Denmark with severe economic consequences should Copenhagen refuse to negotiate Greenland's future.
People really don't even know if Denmark has any legal right to it. But if they do, they should give it up because we need it for national security. That's for the free world. I'm talking about protecting the free world.
Our correspondent Anthony Zerker was watching the speech. So is this Mr. Trump being deliberately provocative to grab headlines, or do we need to take him seriously?
That's the big question about everything that Donald Trump does. Is there strategy behind it, or is he just flying by the seat of his pants, saying what comes to mind and letting the chips fall where they may? He has talked about Greenland before. He has talked about Canada before. But even in his first term, he did talk about entertaining a bid to annex Greenland. So this isn't coming exactly out of nowhere. But the fact that this is something he's brought up multiple times now, and his son was in Greenland today, that shows that on the eve of his presidency that this is something that he is thinking about at the very least.
Well, yes, but it does seem not to chime with his sort of isolationist ideas as well. You know, he's talked about not really wanting to be a great fan of NATO anymore, but this sounds like territorial expansion, doesn't it?
It does. And of course, Denmark is a member of NATO. So to not rule out military coercion when trying to acquire territory from one of our own allies in the most cherished military alliance that the United States is a member of is pretty remarkable. So on one hand, yes, Donald Trump doesn't think that U.S. soldiers should be engaged in wars around the world. And he does talk about, brag about how the United States didn't engage in any new wars during his first term. He seems perfectly happy to rattle his sabers and use the threat of military force to accomplish this goal.
And that was our correspondent Anthony Zerker there, who was watching that speech earlier today.
What do Tiger Woods, Mark Zuckerberg, and Taylor Swift all have in common? Well, their lives and fortunes are all being discussed on Good Bad Billionaire, the podcast exploring the minds, motives, and the money of some of the world's wealthiest individuals. I'm Xing Xing, and each week my co-presenter Simon Jack and I take a closer look at the world's mega rich, and we try to decide whether they're good, bad, or just another billionaire. From celebs and CEOs to sports stars and tech titans, find out how billionaires made their money and how they use it. Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. All episodes of season 1 and 2 are available now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And click follow or subscribe so you never miss a new episode.
Welcome back to NewsHour. It's just been a very stressful time in India. It always is around this time with the annual civil service examinations and the chance to secure a coveted job in government. Students in the state of Bihar have been protesting for weeks, though, claiming that there were irregularities in the tests. Archana Shukla reports from there.
I'm in Patna and it's early morning on the banks of River Ganga. About 100 students, all in the age group of 18 to 25, are giving a mock test. They are preparing for competitive exams in hopes of a good government job. That's the teacher reading out the right answers and students are marking themselves on the multiple choice questionnaire. It's one of the most extraordinary sights. Most of them cannot afford private training centers and hence have made this public promenade their classroom. They are desperate. Government exams are their only shot at a stable career and they try year after year. But their dreams are crushed each time by cheating scandals and frauds where question papers are leaked for money. 25-year-old Akash Kumar, a graduate, works by day and studies for a police recruitment exam by night. But in the last 2 years, papers were leaked and exams cancelled.
If paper leaks keep happening, poor students will never be able to realize their dreams of becoming officers. My father works as a construction worker, but hopes I will get a government job so my family doesn't struggle for daily wages anymore.
Competition is fierce. Millions are vying for a few thousand government jobs. Hundreds of miles away, a sleepy village in Uttar Pradesh bears testimony. In a quiet house, Lakshman Pal Singh sits, grieving. His 26-year-old son struggled to find a secure job for years. Last February, he was one of around 5 million who took an exam to fill 60,000 constable posts. But exams were leaked again.
After the paper leak, I consoled him and told him it's okay, but he was shattered. The next morning, he took his life. He had burned all his college certificates. He said his degrees were useless if they can't get him a job. Our only hope is gone. What do we look forward to?
In 2024 alone, six major exams were compromised and nearly 10 million students left in the lurch. Enraged, the students have been protesting across the country. As pressure mounted, the government, first dismissive of any failure, has promised reforms. India's education minister Dharmendra Pradhan told reporters in December the overhaul could be slow but sure to minimize irregularities. Back in Patna, these students still keep trying. After all, the dream of a better life is all they have to hold on to.
The BBC's Archana Shukla reporting. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Jean-Marie Le Pen, the far-right politician that founded the French National Front in 1972, has died. He was 96, a convicted racist and an anti-Semite. He was a man who was seen as a political pariah and yet whose influence and reach can still be felt today. He came to international attention in 2002 when he led a surprise challenge for the presidency, reaching the second round, the runoff, before losing heavily to Jacques Chirac. His daughter, Marine Le Pen, has both followed in his footsteps but also tried to distance herself from him and some of his most extreme policies. She renamed the party, calling it National Rally, and has succeeded in turning it into a major force in French politics. Andrew Harding looks back now at the political life of Jean-Marie Le Pen.
Vive le Front National! Vive la France!
He was, for years, the most divisive figure in all of France. Jean-Marie Le Pen, his surname like a bullet ricocheting through French politics. Le Pen was born in rural obscurity, but he studied law and then became a soldier, fighting in the wars that marked the end of France's colonial empire. In the 1970s, Le Pen founded the extreme-right National Front.
Les nations ont cessé d'exister en tant que telles.
He was a brash, even thuggish populist, opposed to European integration and to large-scale immigration.
Je vais faire courir, moi, tu vas voir le rouquin là-bas. Pédé!
You can hear Le Pen here shouting crude insults at one protester. And coming close to blows here with a socialist critic, a woman. But it was his views about the past that provoked the most outrage. He defended France's wartime collaboration with the Nazis and described the gas chambers and genocide of 6 million Jews as a detail of history. Even Le Pen's close advisor, Bruno Gollnisch, winced at that.
I consider that it was a mistake, but it's absolutely ridiculous to reduce the work of such a statesman whose speeches, analyses, books, it covers maybe 30 or 40,000 pages. And to reduce to this only words, absolutely ridiculous.
In the 1980s, Le Pen began inching closer to serious political power. And finally, in 2002, he shocked France by getting through to a second round runoff for the presidency itself.
Énorme surprise, Jean-Marie Le Pen semble...
It was Le Pen's political peak.
I am ready to win. If the French people want, win also.
Instead, Le Pen lost heavily, many French uniting against him in disgust. And soon, he would be eclipsed by his own daughter, Marine Le Pen. She took over the National Front and sought to soften slightly its image, eventually expelling her father in the process. He felt betrayed. It's a crime, he declared here, saying he was ashamed that his daughter carried his surname. But later, the two patched things up. History may well nudge Jean-Marie Le Pen to the sidelines, too extreme, too much the maverick for French tastes. But his name lives on, and so do many of his beliefs, reshaped by his daughter, the Le Pens, still challenging and reshaping French politics.
Andrew Harding with that report. Well, Cécile Aldoui is Professor of French Studies at Stanford University, Associate Scholar at Sciences Po in Paris, and the author of a book on Marine Le Pen. So how does she think Jean-Marie Le Pen will be remembered politically in France?
He's going to be remembered as the man who single-handedly put the far right on the map. He took a marginal French party in the 70s, and now it's here, Marine Le Pen, has the most important political party in France.
And how much of that was driven by his own personality or his policies?
I think it's a mix of a very shrewd political and media agenda, where he used inflammatory discourse to draw attention to his party, and a coincidence with rising topics in public opinion, such as immigration. He was a Trump before Trump in terms of media strategy. He drew attention to himself with polemics, for instance, calling the Holocaust a detail in history, and that really put him in the spotlight. He was certainly ahead of everybody else in understanding how the media was going to work and how they're going to favor polemics over substance. However, his platform really got an interest in the French population only after he left the National Front and his daughter took over, because the coincidence with what was happening, Islamist terrorism, for instance, happening in France in 2015.
So, I mean, he was seen as a very divisive character as well, wasn't he? He was convicted several times, openly racist in every direction, it seems. His daughter, who you've mentioned, Marine Le Pen, has obviously spent years now distancing herself and the party from the one that her father built. She's even renamed it. She said she wanted to detoxify the party. Has she done that?
she has inherited the platform and did not change anything to the political measures that Jean-Marie Le Pen was advancing, such as stripping some rights from immigrants and children of immigrants or forbidding dual citizenship. But she has polished and made over the entire image and discourse. The thing is, Jean-Marie Le Pen was both the person who gave her this springboard and the obstacle to her rise to power. So he was a very ambiguous figure in her political and personal life.
And I suppose now she and others are in a difficult position. Now there's a delicate balance to be struck, really, isn't there, between marking his passing, but also keeping a political distance, because everybody's viewing the next presidential election and she'll be hoping to do well in it.
Absolutely. You know, it's a really double-edged moment for the party because on the one hand, they have to pay respect to the tremendous figure he was. At the same time, all the obituaries are going to dig up his racism, homophobia, misogyny, and so on and so forth. So what has been happening now is that they are euphemizing his legacy as that of a populist, a man of the people for the people.
So in death, could Jean-Marie Le Pen still be something of a political liability for his daughter then?
Absolutely, especially because we're not talking just a few comments. He was very proud to have committed torture during the Algerian War. He was a Holocaust denier. He was violent against women. The core structure of his political leanings were on the extreme.
Professor Cécile Auldwy. In South Korea, it's now considered dangerous to be a feminist. The backlash to women's rights has become so fierce that those who advocate for gender equality are accused of being man-haters and face severe consequences. Online, young men hunt down women they even suspect of having feminist views and try to get them fired from their jobs. And this online violence has spilled into real life. It's left women too scared to admit they're feminists, as our Seoul correspondent Jean McKenzie's been finding out.
Can you show me some of the abusive messages that you received?
Some say goodbye. Another says you must be pretty comfortable with your life because you've sabotaged your job. You're drinking poison and if you keep drinking it, you will die.
We're calling this woman Doreen. She draws animations for video games. And one night, after completing a big project for one of Korea's most popular games, Maple Story, she was flooded with these abusive messages.
Others say, your mum is a cripple. And there are swear words I'd never heard before. I was so shocked.
Doreen had become the target of a vicious online witch hunt where young men try to get feminists fired from their jobs. They often target women who work in the gaming industry, trawling their social media to find any trace of feminism, then pressuring their companies to sack them. And way back on Doreen's timeline, they'd found a supportive post.
People started filing complaints to the Maple Story team. This person is a feminist, they said. My company and the CEO, we were all in a panic. There were so many complaints by people wanting me to be fired.
This backlash to feminism has been slowly escalating. Women here suffer from severe discrimination, misogyny, and sexual violence. And as feminists have fought to improve women's rights, young men have pushed back.
It's so bad. It's worse than I remember. Good God.
Can you read me some of the messages?
Okay. Korean women are spreading poison in the well. It's all just general misogyny.
I'm sitting with Min-Sung Kim. He's a big online gamer, and we're looking through some popular online message boards, and they're just full of misogynistic abuse. Min-Sung used to belong to these forums, but now he calls himself an ardent feminist, and he's working to support women who are being attacked. He even managed to convince Doreen's company not to fire her.
Why do these men have such a problem with feminists?
By their alternate reality, men are actually being systematically repressed, being systematically discriminated against feminists just want to take away men's rights. They're confident now that when you accuse someone of feminism, you can ruin their career.
Because these witch hunts do work. There are cases where women have lost their jobs. And for one woman, the violence spilled offline and into real life. We're calling her Chigu.
He exploded and started banging on the counter with his hand and throwing things at me. He said, "Hey, you're a feminist, right? You look like a feminist with your short hair."
Chigu was working alone in a convenience store late at night when the man came in and started attacking her.
He grabbed my arm and pushed me very hard against the shelves. Then he pushed me down to the ground and started punching my face and kicking my body so I wouldn't be able to get up. He said, "I never hit women. I've never even hit my mum. But feminists need to get beaten." I kept going in and out of consciousness, and at some point, he picked me up and threw me. I thought I could die.
Chigu has been left with permanent injuries, and her attack has frightened women here. These witch hunters have successfully hijacked feminism, distorting its meaning. By branding all feminists man-haters and attacking them, they've stripped women of the ability to fight for better rights in a country where men and women are still far from equal.
Jean McKenzie with that report from South Korea, and you can hear more on the assignment programme on World Service. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Rescue workers have been struggling in freezing temperatures in a remote area of Tibet near Mount Everest today to reach survivors of a powerful earthquake in the foothills of the Himalayas. At least 126 people are known to have been killed, but many more injured, according to Chinese state media. Hundreds of buildings have been destroyed in the historic city of Shigatse, very important to Tibet. Tibetan Buddhists. This is how the news anchor from CCTV broke the story.
Let's look at the latest news. According to the China Earthquake Network Center, an earthquake of around magnitude 6.9 occurred today at 9.05 a.m. near the Tingri County, Shigatse City, Tibet. The final result will be based on the official report.
Well, that magnitude has since been increased to 7.1, and as often happens, there have also been a series of powerful aftershocks. Videos posted to social media show buildings with walls sheared off, rescue workers clambering over rubble, trying to listen for voices of survivors, and trying to pull heavy debris away just with their hands. Hundreds of people will be sleeping outside tonight because of the fear of unstable buildings, and the temperature is likely to get down to minus 18 before dawn. Ekdev Adhikari leads the National Emergency Operations Centre in Nepal.
My team now is assessing the situation, and coordination was established with the local authorities, first responders, but we have the difficulty of the rock terrain, highest Himalayan terrain, including some of the world's highest peaks. And this time is winter season, so the temperature is also freezing.
Well, foreign journalists are usually not permitted into Tibet, so our correspondent Laura Bicker is monitoring events from Beijing.
Well, we've just had an update on the death toll. 126 people have now died, with more than 188 injured. 28 critically injured people have been transferred to other hospitals for treatment. Now, we're hearing that thousands of households have had their homes collapse. We've seen images coming on state media. We're monitoring it here in Beijing because, as you've mentioned, we would need special permission from the government as foreign journalists to enter Tibet. So we've seen, and we're monitoring Chinese state media, where we've seen rescuers who have been swift on the scene. They are going house to house, which these are low built mountain homes. They've just simply collapsed at the strength of this quake. They are pulling bodies from the rubble. They are pulling some survivors. We've seen a lot of elderly and a lot of young people cradled within the rubble and also being treated on site. The army have also arrived on scene. They've erected tents. Now, I can't emphasise the freezing temperatures enough, because we've just heard that it's now minus 18 Celsius in this region with no shelter. This is the strongest quake they've had in 5 years. It is prone to quakes. It is does sit on the fault line. But these are buildings that have managed to cope during other quakes. This has been a particularly strong and particularly shallow earthquake that has hit this very, very remote region. This certainly has been the strongest quake they've seen in this region in 5 years.
Well, one of the areas affected was Mount Everest itself. It's in the middle of winter, of course, treacherous conditions for climbing, so not many people there. But one person who was is climber Jost Kobusch. He was attempting a solo climb of Everest's West Ridge and was camped on the edge of the mountain when the earthquake hit.
Well, I was up on Everest and my tent was shaken very hardly this morning. So I woke up to realize I was surrounded by avalanches coming down the mountain.
Goodness. Okay. And so just tell us where you are on Everest, because I think you're on your own as well, aren't you?
Exactly. So I'm trying to solo climb Everest in the winter without oxygen on the West Ridge. So I'm not climbing the normal route. I'm climbing a technical route that is rocky and icy and steep. So I'm in my tent on a granite balcony at 5,700 in a steep wall. And that's exactly when the earthquake hit.
Goodness. Were you worried that you would even be thrown off the ridge? I mean, it's not a very large area.
One of the biggest challenges of climbing Everest in the winter is the extreme wind speed up there. So my tent was very, very well secured, and it's in a spot where I was sure I couldn't be hit by any rocks or ice. So in a way, I felt very safe, but there were big parts of glaciers collapsing and exploding around me, and the shock waves hit me, and, well, some bits of ice hit the tent, and, well, let's put it this way, the tent has seen its last expedition.
So just explain the shock waves. How long did that go on for, and what was that like? And also you mentioned the avalanches, but I presume those are still a threat to you at the moment.
Right now, at the moment, I'm actually back to the base camp and I'm in a safe spot. I'm not in that camp anymore. But being up there, it's basically left and right. There are, yeah, big chunks of glacier that are falling down, collapsing, forming avalanches. But also, it's just like explosion shock waves from this ice collapsing, and fine snow particles, sometimes less fine, pushing against the tent.
Well, it's very dangerous. I mean, you talk about ice, but the kind of ice, the impacted hard ice that would be there raining down on you could do you some serious injury.
Absolutely. This could potentially kill you.
I have to ask you this. It's incredibly dangerous what you do. Why do you do it?
To me, alpinism is a journey into the unknown, and I'm very curious about what awaits me up there, and I'm very curious about what I can achieve as an athlete, as a human being, and therefore I'm very much drawn to this.
But was there any part of you when this quake was going on and you're on that windy ledge, very narrow with ice falling on you, was there any part of you at that point that questioned your decision to go up in the first place?
There was no time to question anything. It was more like observing and seeing what's going on and making sure that I'm actually in a safe space.
Climber Jost Kobusch there, speaking to us from the relative safety of base camp on Mount Everest earlier today. That's it for this edition of NewsHour from me and the whole team here in London. Thanks very much for joining us.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohammed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.